And since I presume Bliss has tried to quiet her by hinting that if we don't find Earth, we'll take her back to Solaria, she may even have worked up the notion that Solaria is close to Earth. But how can you tell this, Golan? What makes you think it's so? She as much as told us so, Genoff, when we burst in upon her. She cried out that she wanted to go to Solaria, and then added, "There, there," nodding her head at the viewscreen. And what is on the viewscreen? Earth's satellite. It wasn't there when I left the machine before dinner. Earth was. But Phelim must have pictured the satellite in her mind when she asked for Solaria, and the computer, in response, must therefore have focused on the satellite. Believe me, Janoff, I know how this computer works. Who would know better? Pellerat looked at the thick crescent of light on the viewscreen and said thoughtfully, "It was called Moon in at least one of Earth's languages, Luna in another language, probably many other names, too. Imagine the confusion, old chap, on a world with numerous languages, the misunderstandings, the complications, the..." "Moon," said Trevis. "Well, that's simple enough. Then, too, come to think of it, it may be that the child tried instinctively to move the ship by means of its transducer lobes, using the ship's own energy source, and that may have helped produce the momentary inertial confusion. But none of that matters, Janoff. What does matter is that all this has brought this Moon, yes, I like the name, to the screen and magnified it, and there it still is. I'm looking at it now and wondering." "Wondering what, Golan?" "At the size of it." "We tend to ignore satellites, Janoff. They're such little things when they exist at all. This one is different, though. It's a world. It has a diameter of about 3,500 kilometers." "A world? Surely you wouldn't call it a world. It can't be habitable. Even a 3,500-kilometer diameter is too small. It has no atmosphere. I can tell that just by looking at it. No clouds. The circular curve against space is sharp. So is the inner curve that bounds the light and dark hemisphere." Trevis nodded. "You're getting to be a seasoned space traveler, Janoff. You're right. No air, no water. But that only means the Moon's not habitable on its unprotected surface. What about underground?" "Underground?" said Pellerat doubtfully. "Yes, underground. Why not? Earth's cities were underground, you tell me. We know that Trantor was underground. Camporeon has much of its capital city underground. The Solarian mansions were almost entirely underground. It's a very common state of affairs." "But Golan, in every one of these cases, people were living on a habitable planet. The surface was habitable, too, with an atmosphere and with an ocean. Is it possible to live underground when the surface is uninhabitable?" "Come, Janoff, think. Where are we living right now? The far star is a tiny world that has an uninhabitable surface. There's no air or water on the outside. Yet we live inside in perfect comfort. The galaxy is full of space stations and space settlements of infinite variety, to say nothing of spaceships, and they're all uninhabitable, except for the interior. Consider the Moon a gigantic spaceship."
"With a crew inside?"
"Yes. Millions of people, for all we know. And plants and animals. And an advanced technology." "Look, Janoff, doesn't it make sense? If Earth, in its last days, could send out a party of settlers to a planet orbiting Alpha Centauri, and if, possibly with Imperial help, they could attempt to terraform it, seed its oceans, build dry land where there was none, could Earth not also send a party to its satellite and terraform its interior?" Pellerat said reluctantly.
I suppose so. It would be done. If Earth has something to hide, why send it over a parsec away, when it could be hidden on a world less than 100 millionth the distance to Alpha? And the moon would be a more efficient hiding place from the psychological standpoint. No one would think of satellites in connection with life. For that matter, I didn't. With the moon an inch before my nose, my thoughts went herring off to Alpha. If it hadn't been for Phelim... His lips tightened, and he shook his head. I suppose I'll have to credit her for that. Bliss surely will if I don't.
Pellerat said,
But see here, old man. If there's something hiding under the surface of the moon, how do we find it? There must be millions of square kilometers of surface.
Roughly 40 million.
And we would have to inspect all of that. Looking for what? An opening? Some sort of airlock?
Trevia said, Put that way, it would seem rather a task. But we're not just looking for objects. We're looking for life, and for intelligent life at that. And we've got Bliss. And detecting intelligence is her talent, isn't it?
98.
Bliss looked at Trevise accusingly. I've finally got her to sleep. I had the hardest time. She was wild. Fortunately, I don't think I've damaged her.
Trevise said coldly, You might try removing her fixation on Jemby, you know, since I certainly have no intention of ever going back to Solaria.
Just remove her fixation, is that it? What do you know about such things, Trevise? You've never sensed a mind. You haven't the faintest idea of its complexity. If you knew anything at all about it, you wouldn't talk about removing a fixation as though it were just a matter of scooping jam out of a jar.
Well, weaken it at least.
I might weaken it a bit after a month of careful de-threading.
What do you mean, de-threading?
To someone who doesn't know, it can't be explained.
What are you going to do with the child, then?
I don't know yet. It will take a lot of consideration.
In that case, said Trevise, let me tell you what we're going to do with the ship.
I know what you're going to do. It's back to New Earth, and another try at the lovely Hiroko, if she'll promise not to infect you this time.
Trevise kept his face expressionless. He said, No, as a matter of fact, I've changed my mind. We're going to the moon, which is the name of the satellite, according to Janoff.
The satellite? Because it's the nearest world at hand? I hadn't thought of that.
Nor I. Nor would anyone have thought of it. Nowhere in the galaxy is there a satellite worth thinking about. But this satellite, in being large, is unique. What's more, Earth's anonymity covers it as well. Anyone who can't find the Earth can't find the moon either.
Is it habitable?
Not on the surface. But it is not radioactive, not at all. So it isn't absolutely uninhabitable. It may have life. It may be teeming with life, in fact, under the surface. And, of course, you'll be able to tell if that's so once we get close enough.
Bliss shrugged. I'll try. But then, what made you suddenly think of trying the satellite?
Trevise said quietly, Something Phelim did when she was at the controls.
Bliss waited, as though expecting more, then shrugged again. Whatever it was, I suspect you wouldn't have gotten the inspiration if you had followed your own impulse and killed her.
I had no intention of killing her, Bliss.
Bliss waved her hand.
All right, let it be. Are we moving toward the moon now?
Yes. As a matter of caution, I'm not going too fast, but if all goes well, we'll be in its vicinity in 30 hours.
99.
The moon was a wasteland. Trevise watched the bright daylit portion drifting past them below. It was a monotonous panorama of crater rings and mountainous areas, and of shadows black against the sunlight. There were subtle color changes in the soil, and occasional sizable stretches of flatness, broken by small craters. As they approached the night side, the shadows grew longer and finally fused together. For a while behind them, peaks glittered in the sun like fat stars, far outshining their brethren in the sky. Then they disappeared, and below was only the fainter light of the earth in the sky, a large bluish-white sphere, a little more than half full. The ship finally outran the earth, too, which sank beneath the horizon, so that under them was unrelieved blackness, and above only the faint powdering of stars, which to Trevise, who had been brought up on the starless world of Terminus, was always miracle enough. Then new bright stars appeared ahead, first just one or two, then others, expanding and thickening, and finally coalescing, and at once they passed the Terminator into the daylit side. The sun rose with infernal splendor, while the viewscreen shifted away from it at once and polarized the glare of the ground beneath. Trevise could see quite well that it was useless to hope to find any way into the inhabited interior, if that existed, by mere eye inspection of this perfectly enormous world. He turned to look at Bliss, who sat beside him. She did not look at the viewscreen. Indeed, she kept her eyes closed. She seemed to have collapsed into the chair, rather than to be sitting in it. Trevise, wondering if she were asleep, said softly, "Do you detect anything else?" Bliss shook her head very slightly. "No," she whispered. "There was just that faint whiff. You'd better take me back there. Do you know where that region was?" "The computer knows."
It was like zeroing in on a target, shifting this way and that, and then finding it. The area in question was still deep in the night side, and, except that the earth shone fairly low in the sky and gave the surface a ghostly ashen glow between the shadows, there was nothing to make out, even though the light in the pilot room had been blacked out for better viewing.
Pellerat had approached and was standing anxiously in the doorway.
"Have we found anything?"
he asked in a husky whisper.
Trevise held up his hand for silence. He was watching Bliss. He knew it would be days before sunlight would return to this spot on the moon, but he also knew that, for what Bliss was trying to sense, light of any kind was irrelevant. She said,
"It's there."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes."
"And it's the only spot?"
"It's the only spot I've detected. Have you been over every part of the moon's surface?"
"We've been over a respectable fraction of it."
"Well then, in that respectable fraction, this is all I have detected. It's stronger now, as though it has detected us, and it doesn't seem dangerous. The feeling I get is a welcoming one."
"Are you sure?"
"It's the feeling I get."
Pellerat said,
"Could it be faking the feeling?"
Bliss said with a trace of hauteur, "I would detect a fake, I assure you."
Trevise muttered something about overconfidence, then said, "What you detect is intelligence, I hope."
"I detect strong intelligence, except..."
And an odd note entered her voice.
"Except what?" Shh! Don't disturb me. Let me concentrate.
The last word was a mere motion of her lips. Then she said, in faint, elated surprise,
"It's not human."
"Not human?" said Trevise, in much stronger surprise. "Are we dealing with robots again, as on Solaria?"
"No."
Bliss was smiling. "It's not quite robotic, either." "It has to be one or the other."
"Neither."
She actually chuckled. "It's not human, and yet it's not like any robot I've detected before."
Pellerat said, "I would like to see that."
He nodded his head vigorously, his eyes wide with pleasure.
"It would be exciting. Something new."
"Something new," muttered Trevise, with a sudden lift of his own spirits. And a flash of unexpected insight seemed to illuminate the interior of his skull.
100. Down they sank to the moon's surface in what was almost jubilation. Even Phelim had joined them now, and with the abandonment of a youngster, was hugging herself with unbearable joy as though she were truly returning to Solaria. As for Trevise, he felt within himself a touch of sanity, telling him that it was strange that Earth, or whatever of Earth was on the moon, which had taken such measures to keep off all others, should now be taking measures to draw them in. Could the purpose be the same in either way? Was it a case of, if you can't make them avoid you, draw them in and destroy them? Either way, would not Earth's secret remain untouched? But that thought faded and drowned in the flood of joy that deepened steadily as they came closer to the moon's surface. Yet over and beyond that, he managed to cling to the moment of illumination that had reached him just before they had begun their gliding dive to the surface of the Earth satellite. He seemed to have no doubt as to where the ship was going. They were just above the tops of the rolling hills now, and Trevise, at the computer, felt no need to do anything. It was as though he and the computer both were being guided, and he felt only an enormous euphoria at having the weight of responsibility taken away from him. They were sliding parallel to the ground, toward a cliff that raised its menacing height as a barrier against them, a barrier glistening faintly in earthshine and in the light beam of the far star. The approach of certain collision seemed to mean nothing to Trevise, and it was with no surprise whatever that he became aware that the section of cliff directly ahead had fallen away, and that a corridor, gleaming in artificial light, had opened before them. The ship slowed to a crawl, apparently of its own accord, and fitted neatly into the opening. Entering, sliding along. The opening closed behind it, and another then opened before it. Through the second opening went the ship, into a gigantic hall that seemed the hollowed interior of a mountain. The ship halted, and all aboard rushed to the airlock eagerly. It occurred to none of them, not even to Trevise, to check whether there might be a breathable atmosphere outside, or any atmosphere at all. There was air, however. It was breathable, and it was comfortable. They looked about themselves with the pleased air of people who had somehow come home, and it was only after a while that they became aware of a man who was waiting politely for them to approach. He was tall, and his expression was grave. His hair was bronze in color and cut short. His cheekbones were broad, his eyes were bright, and his clothing was rather after the fashion one saw in ancient history books. Although he seemed sturdy and vigorous, There was, just the same, an air of weariness about him. Not in anything that one could see, but rather in something appealing to no recognizable sense. It was Phelim who reacted first. With a loud, whistling scream, she ran toward the man, waving her arms and crying, "Jimby! Jimby!" in a breathless fashion. She never slackened her pace, and when she was close enough, the man stooped and lifted her high in the air. She threw her arms about his neck, sobbing, and still gasping, "Jimby!" The others approached more soberly, and Trevise said slowly and distinctly, "Could this man understand Galactic?" "We ask pardon, sir. This child has lost her protector and is searching for it desperately. How it came to fasten on you is a puzzle to us, since it is seeking a robot, a mechanical..." The man spoke for the first time. His voice was utilitarian rather than musical, and there was a faint air of archaism clinging to it. But he spoke Galactic with perfect ease. "I greet you all in friendship," he said, and he seemed unmistakably friendly, even though his face continued to remain fixed in its expression of gravity. "As for this child," he went on, "she shows perhaps a greater perceptivity than you think, for I am a robot. My name is Daniil Oliva." Chapter 21, the last chapter. The search ends. 101. Trevise found himself in a complete state of disbelief. He had recovered from the odd euphoria he had felt just before and after the landing on the moon. A euphoria, he now suspected, that had been imposed on him by this self-styled robot who now stood before him. Trevise was still staring, and in his now perfectly sane and untouched mind, he remained lost in astonishment. He had talked in astonishment, made conversation in astonishment, scarcely understood what he said or heard as he searched for something in the appearance of this apparent man, in his behavior, in his manner of speaking, that bespoke the robot. No wonder, thought Trevise, that Bliss had detected something that was neither human nor robot, but that was, in Pellerat's words, something new. Just as well, of course, for it had turned Trevise's thoughts into another and more enlightening channel. But even that was now crowded into the back of his mind. Bliss and Phelim had wandered off to explore the grounds. It had been Bliss's suggestion, but it seemed to Trevise that it came after a lightning-quick glance had been exchanged between herself and Daniil. When Phelim refused and asked to stay with the being she persisted in calling Jimby, a grave word from Daniil and a lift of the finger was enough to cause her to trot off at once. Trevise and Pellerat remained. "They are not Foundationers, sir," said the robot, as though that explained it all. "One is Gaia, and one is a spacer." Trevise remained silent while they were led to simply designed chairs under a tree. They seated themselves at a gesture from the robot, and when he sat down too, in a perfectly human movement, Trevise said, "Are you truly a robot?" "Truly, sir," said Daniil. Pellerat's face seemed to shine with joy. He said, "There are references to a robot named Daniil in the old legends. Are you named in his honor?" "I am that robot," said Daniil. "It is not a legend." "Oh, no," said Pellerat. "If you are that robot, you would have to be thousands of years old." 20,000, said Daniil quietly. Pellerat seemed abashed at that and glanced at Trevise, who said with a touch of anger, "If you are a robot, I order you to speak truthfully."
"I do not need to be told to speak truthfully, sir. I must do so."
"You are faced, then, sir, with three alternatives. Either I am a man who is lying to you, or I am a robot who has been programmed to believe that it is 20,000 years old, but in fact is not, or I am a robot who is 20,000 years old. You must decide which alternative to accept."
"The matter may decide itself with continued conversation," said Trevise dryly.
"For that matter, it is hard to believe that this is the interior of the moon. Neither the light..."
He looked up as he said that, for the light was precisely that of soft, diffuse sunlight, though no sun was in the sky, and for that matter, no sky was clearly visible. "Nor the gravity seems credible. This world should have a surface gravity of less than 0.2 g.
"The normal surface gravity would be 0.16 g, actually, sir. It is built up, however, by the same forces that give you, on your ship, the sensation of normal gravity, even when you are in free fall or under acceleration. Other energy needs, including the light, are also met gravitically, though we use solar energy where that is convenient. Our material needs are all supplied by the moon's soil, except for the light elements, hydrogen, carbon, and nitrogen, which the moon does not possess. We obtain those by capturing an occasional comet. One such capture a century is more than enough to supply our needs."
"I take it Earth is useless as a source of supply."
"Unfortunately, that is so, sir. Our positronic brains are as sensitive to radioactivity as human proteins are."
"You use the plural, and this mansion before us seems large, beautiful, and elaborate, at least as seen from the outside. There are then other beings on the moon? Humans? Robots?"
"Yes, sir. We have a complete ecology on the moon, and a vast and complex hollow within which that ecology exists. The intelligent beings are all robots, however, more or less like myself. You will see none of them, however. As for this mansion, it is used by myself only, and it is an establishment that is modeled exactly on one I used to live in 20,000 years ago."
"Which you remember in detail, do you?"
"Perfectly, sir. I was manufactured and existed for a time, how brief a time it seems to me now, on the spacer world of Aurora."
"The one with the..."
Trevise paused.
"Yes, sir, the one with the dogs."
"You know about that?"
"Yes, sir."
"How do you come to be here, then, if you lived at first on Aurora?"
"Sir, it was to prevent the creation of a radioactive Earth that I came here in the very beginnings of the settlement of the galaxy. There was another robot with me, named Giscard, who could sense and adjust minds."
"As Bliss can?"
"Yes, sir. We failed in a way, and Giscard ceased to operate. Before the cessation, however, he made it possible for me to have his talent, and left it to me to care for the galaxy, for Earth particularly."
"Why Earth particularly?"
"In part because of a man named Elijah Bailey, an Earthman."
Pellerat put in excitedly, "He is the culture hero I mentioned some time ago, Golan."
"A culture hero, sir?"
"What Dr. Pellerat means," said Trevise, "is that he is a person to whom much was attributed, and who may have been an amalgamation of many men in actual history, or who may be an invented person altogether." Daniil considered for a moment, and then said quite calmly, "That is not so, sirs. Elijah Bailey was a real man, and he was one man. I do not know what your legends say of him, but in actual history, the galaxy might never have been settled without him. In his honor, I did my best to salvage what I could of Earth after it began to turn radioactive. My fellow robots were distributed over the galaxy in an effort to influence a person here, a person there. At one time, I maneuvered a beginning to the recycling of Earth's soil. At another, much later time, I maneuvered a beginning to the terraforming of a world circling the nearby star, now called Alpha. In neither case was I truly successful. I could never adjust human minds entirely as I wished, for there was always the chance that I might do harm to the various humans who were adjusted. I was bound, you see, and am bound to this day, by the laws of robotics."
"Yes?"
It did not necessarily take a being with Daniil's mental power to detect uncertainty in that monosyllable. "The first law," he said, "is this, sir. A robot may not injure a human being, or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. The second law. A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. The third law. A robot must protect its own existence, as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. Naturally, I give you these laws in the approximation of language. In actual fact, they represent complicated mathematical configurations of our positronic brain paths. Do you find it difficult to deal with those laws?"
"I must, sir."
"The first law is an absolute that almost forbids the use of my mental talents altogether. When dealing with the galaxy, it is not likely that any course of action will prevent harm altogether. Always some people, perhaps many people, will suffer, so that a robot must choose minimum harm. Yet the complexity of possibilities is such that it takes time to make that choice, and one is even then never certain."
"I see that," said Trevise.
"All through galactic history," said Daniil, "I tried to ameliorate the worst aspects of the strife and disaster that perpetually made itself felt in the galaxy. I may have succeeded on occasion and to some extent, but if you know your galactic history, you will know that I did not succeed often or by much."
"That much I know," said Trevise with a wry smile.
Just before Giscard's end, he conceived of a robotic law that superseded even the first. We called it the Zeroth Law, out of an inability to think of any other name that made sense. The Zeroth Law is, a robot may not injure humanity, or through inaction allow humanity to come to harm. This automatically means that the first law must be modified to be, a robot may not injure a human being, or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm, except where that would conflict with the Zeroth Law. And similar modifications must be made in the second and third laws.
Trevise frowned.
"How do you decide what is injurious or not injurious to humanity as a whole?"
"Precisely, sir," said Daniil. "In theory, the Zeroth Law was the answer to our problems. In practice, we could never decide. A human being is a concrete object. Injury to a person can be estimated and judged. Humanity is an abstraction. How do we deal with it?"
"I don't know," said Trevise.
"Wait,"
said Pellerat. You could convert humanity into a single organism, Gaia.
That is what I tried to do, sir. I engineered the founding of Gaia. If humanity could be made a single organism, it would become a concrete object, and it could be dealt with. It was, however, not as easy to create a superorganism as I had hoped. In the first place, it could not be done unless human beings valued the superorganism more than their individuality, and I had to find a mindcast that would allow that. It was a long time before I thought of the laws of robotics.
Ah, then, the Gaians are robots. I had suspected that from the start.
In that case, you suspected incorrectly, sir. They are human beings, but they have brains firmly inculcated with the equivalent of the laws of robotics. They have to value life, really value it. And even after that was done, there remained a serious flaw. A superorganism consisting of human beings only is unstable. It cannot be set up. Other animals must be added, then plants, then the inorganic world. The smallest superorganism that is truly stable is an entire world, and a world large enough and complex enough to have a stable ecology. It took a long time to understand this, and it is only in this last century that Gaia was fully established, and that it became ready to move on toward Galaxia. And even so, that will take a long time, too. Perhaps not as long as the road already traveled, however, since we now know the rules.
But you needed me to make the decision for you. Is that it, Daniil?
Yes, sir. The laws of robotics would not allow me, nor Gaia, to make the decision and chance harm to humanity. And meanwhile, 5 centuries ago, when it seemed that I would never work out methods for getting round all the difficulties that stood in the way of establishing Gaia, I turned to the second best and helped bring about the development of the science of psychohistory.
I might have guessed that, mumbled Trevise.
You know, Daniil, I'm beginning to believe you are 20,000 years old.
Thank you, sir.
Pellerat said, Wait a while. I think I see something. Are you part of Gaia yourself, Daniil? Would that be how you knew about the dogs on Aurora, through Bliss?
Daniil said,
In a way, sir, you are correct. I am associated with Gaia, though I am not part of it.
Trevise's eyebrows went up. That sounds like Camporeon, the world we visited immediately after leaving Gaia. It insists it is not part of the Foundation Confederation, but is only associated with it.
Slowly, Daniil nodded. I suppose that analogy is apt, sir. I can, as an associate of Gaia, make myself aware of what Gaia is aware of, in the person of the woman Bliss, for instance. Gaia, however, cannot make itself aware of what I am aware of, so that I maintain my freedom of action. That freedom of action is necessary until Galaxia is well established.
Trevise looked steadily at the robot for a moment, then said, And did you use your awareness through Bliss in order to interfere with events on our journey to mold them to your better liking?
Daniil sighed in a curiously human fashion. I could not do much, sir. The laws of robotics always hold me back. And yet I lightened the load on Bliss's mind, taking a small amount of added responsibility on myself, so that she might deal with the wolves of Aurora and the spacer on Solaria with greater dispatch and with less harm to herself.
In addition, I influence the woman on Comporeon and the one on New Earth, through Bliss, in order to have them look with favor on you, so that you might continue on your journey.
Trevise smiled, half sadly. I ought to have known it wasn't I.
Daniil accepted the statement without its rueful self-deprecation.
On the contrary, sir, he said, it was you in considerable part. Each of the two women looked with favor upon you from the start. I merely strengthened the impulse already present, about all one can safely do under the strictures of the laws of robotics. Because of those strictures, and for other reasons as well, it was only with great difficulty that I brought you here, and only indirectly. I was in great danger at several points of losing you.
And now I am here, said Trevise. What is it you want of me? To confirm my decision in favor of Galaxia?
Daniil's face, always expressionless, somehow managed to seem despairing.
No, sir. The mere decision is no longer enough. I brought you here as best I could in my present condition for something far more desperate. I am dying.
Perhaps it was because of the matter-of-fact way in which Daniil said it, or perhaps because a lifetime of 20,000 years made death seem no tragedy to one doomed to live less than 0.5% of that period. But in any case, Trevise felt no stir of sympathy.
Die? Can a machine die?
I can cease to exist, sir. Call it by whatever word you wish. I am old. Not one sentient being in the galaxy that was alive when I was first given consciousness is still alive today. Nothing organic, nothing robotic. Even I myself lack continuity.
In what way?
There is no physical part of my body, sir, that has escaped replacement, not only once, but many times. Even my positronic brain has been replaced on 5 different occasions. Each time, the contents of my earlier brain were etched into the newer one, to the last positron. Each time, the new brain had a greater capacity and complexity than the old, so that there was room for more memories and for faster decision and action.
But?
The more advanced and complex the brain, the more unstable it is, and the more quickly it deteriorates. My present brain is 100,000 times as sensitive as my first, and has 10 million times the capacity. But whereas my first brain endured for over 10,000 years, the present one is but 600 years old, and is unmistakably senescent. With every memory of 20,000 years perfectly recorded, and with a perfect recall mechanism in place, the brain is filled. There is a rapidly declining ability to reach decisions, an even more rapidly declining ability to test and influence minds at hyperspatial distance.